whose love all creatures share.
Will he not clothe us? Will he not feed us?
Are we not like them, his own?
Fill your chalice at his fountain. Know that you live not alone. Know that you live not alone.
Every morning when I greet the sun, when I move forth through crowded ways, in my heart, Lord, ever so silently, I will always think of thee. In my heart, Lord, ever so silently, I will always think of thee. When I laugh low and when I cry with pain, when my best friends misunderstand, in my heart, Lord, ever so silently, I will always think of thee. In my heart, Lord, ever so silently, I will always think of thee. Silently, I will always think of thee. In my heart, Lord, ever so silently, I will always think of thee. Dear God, my God, I am thine for eternity.
Okay, this morning we're going to talk about the Bible and teachings of Jesus. And when we talked about the Gita, we had a conch to blow. So this morning we have... That reminds us of church bells that are... as close as we could come here, that are in every church, virtually. So, what we have been doing this week, as you know, is to take four different scriptures and talk about them. And it's an important aspect of Master's mission. He was charged with, among other things, one of the primary missions that he had was to show the similarity between the original teachings of Krishna in the Gita and the original teachings of Jesus in the Bible. But more than that, it was to show the essential underlying unity of all religions. And this is especially important in the age that we're currently inhabiting. As we know, there's still tremendous difficulties throughout the world having to do with religious fundamentalism. I don't need to go into all the problems. All you need to do is pick up a newspaper and you're going to see something in there about the problems caused basically with the mindset that my way is the only way, and unless you believe as I do, bad things are going to happen to you. You know, you're going to go to hell, you no possibility of redemption, or I'm going to take your life because you're not living validly, whatever it is. It struck me that if the fundamentalist viewpoint is correct, then there is no heaven, because every one of them says heaven is only for me. And so take, I don't know, a fundamentalist Baptist who says only Baptists can get into heaven. Well, then you've got a fundamentalist Taliban who says only we can get into heaven, and therefore they're mutually exclusive and nobody can get into heaven. So heaven wouldn't exist. So obviously the fundamentalist viewpoint is not only incorrect, but it's causing a lot of mischief. So one of the things that Master was charged with doing was showing the underlying unity in all religions. And it's not just him, it is the time that that has to happen. As we come a little bit more into Dwapara Yuga, it's old religions in Dwapara Yuga are like separated blocks of ice. And with ice, you can move things apart and keep them apart. But as the global climate warms up in Dwapara Yuga, those icebergs melt and they merge. And it's very, very hard to try to keep water separated into its little units. And so right now, we're in the last throes of the mindset that wants to keep things separated. In fact, somebody just sent this morning a little news article that said the Catholic Church is just accepting yoga and meditation as valid for Catholics. You know, I mean, we can kind of chuckle about it, but for them that's a big step, and it's a movement into the unity of all religions. And that's what we're trying to show in part during this week. But this is still a difficult time. It's in the very last time of the mindset of fundamentalism, a little like the end of the age of dinosaurs. They were lonely, they were scared, they were hungry, and it was not a good time to cross them. And so what we have now in America is a growing number of people. In fact, the fastest growing number of people are those who identify themselves as spiritual but not religious. And in fact, I do, and I recently heard that Swami does too. So those of us who do that, I think, are in good company. As Vivekananda said, it is indeed a blessing to be born in a religion, but a curse to die in one. Meaning that we need to get centered in a world that has no directions and no rules. It's easy to wander. But once we have a direction, and once we have absorbed within ourselves that direction, then we no longer need the restrictions of just one way, and we need to broaden that out. And so what we have been reading from and talking about is to show the essential unity of all of these religions that are existent in the world. The spiritual teachings are actually very, very simple. I'm going to kind of summarize it at the end, but it's really, as Sri Yukteswar said, God is simple, all else is complex. And the true spiritual path is very simple. all else is complex. So I'll start with the readings from the Bible. And I want to, I've chosen these readings not only because they are very, very familiar to, ooh, I should have brought my glasses. Do you have yours? In the, oh, yeah, everybody in the room, half the people in the room will either have or have forgotten their reading glasses. I was able to read this just fine in bright light at home, but okay. Now, remember we started out with the reading with the Gita, talking about the incident where Arjuna was kneeling at the feet of Krishna and was given the choice. And he said, Krishna, I choose you. I choose you alone, for where you are, victory is assured. Christ, all of the sentiments are echoed in the Bible, but this is very much echoed. So let's see. Okay. This also echoes the song that we were singing. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these, the lilies of the field. Wherefore, if God so clothed the grass of the field, which today is, and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? So he's answering the same question that Duryodhana is asking. Can I depend on the world for what I need? Obviously, I have to depend. That's why I want the big army. But Arjuna says, no, I want you alone. Well, behind this passage in the Bible is the same question. How do we get our clothing? How do we get our food? How do we get life itself if we can't reach out and depend on ourselves to get that? And this is Christ's answer. Therefore, take no thought, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherewith shall we be clothed? For after all these things do they seek, for your heavenly Father knoweth that ye have need of all these things. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Take therefore no thought for the morrow, for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. So, this is one of the primary teachings of all of the scriptures, is that for our life, for that which we need to gradually cut off our dependence on receiving those things from the world. Remember, Devi said yesterday that the world is a world of sukha-dukha-dham, of pleasure and pain. Master talked about it being like waves on the ocean. You achieve, then you lose, then you achieve. And he said that the trough in between getting and losing, if that trough goes on for any length of time, it produces boredom. And so we self-create those waves so that we keep endlessly looking to the world to not only give us what we want, but we keep looking to the world as if somehow we can freeze it in place once we're at the top of that wave and nothing's going to change again and we're going to be able to hold that position. But obviously, it can't happen. And so we have this endless cycle of ups and downs. Now, it's not that the dependence on things of the world is evil. It's that it's limiting. If you think of basically all of the seven deadly sins that the Bible talks about, or that some teachers have talked about, you take them anger and lust and greed and so on. If you take them and apply them to a lower life form, let's say a tiger, without a certain degree of anger or lust or greed, a tiger can't maintain its life. And so that at a lower level is okay. But remember that one of the things we have to fight against is all of those past teachers and our fathers and grandfathers. And so that long string of what was okay for us in the past now becomes less and less okay until finally at the point where we are, and I'm going to include everybody here, everybody who's a Kriyabhan or aspiring to be a Kriyabhan or a serious meditator, every one of us are at the point where dependence on the world to give us happiness is self-limiting. It's not evil, it's just self-limiting. And therefore, if we seek first the kingdom of God, if we first say, Krishna, I choose you, I choose no one but you, that is the first and most important step in our spiritual life. Because until we do that, we are subject always to the world of sukha dukkha dham, or as it was yesterday in the Rubaiyat, we're a ball on the field getting kicked around. Now, if the ball if the ball was self-intelligent, probably for a while it would really enjoy that. You know, the exhilaration of movement, of going here, of going there, of the movement toward the goal, finally scoring and winning and all of that. Well, that ball isn't too much different from the exhilaration of people who are still enjoying and looking for the world for its self-fulfillment. But after a while, we learn that not only do we get kicked toward the goal, we get kicked away from the goal. And we just plain get kicked around enough so that we come up with a sense of anguishing boredom, painful boredom, and we want a way out. When we want a way out, that's when we've arrived at the state where we have to choose Krishna and we have to choose to seek first the kingdom of God. And then once we do that, then victory is assured. Then all these things shall be added unto you. But without choosing that, we do not get to the point where God takes over and works on our behalf. He lets karma, the law of karma, do it. When Master first met Dr. Lewis, and Dr. Lewis came to him really wanting to find God, wanting to find the light, Master said, "Do you give me your unconditional obedience?" And Dr. Lewis said, "Yes, love and obedience." And when Dr. Lewis said yes, he later said, Master rubbed his hands together like that and said, "Now I can take control of your life. Now I can guide you." So we have to give God, whether in the form of a guru or in the form of our desire for that which is higher, we have to submit our will to that higher will. And when we do, when we open our hearts to God, the Master says, "I will enter and take charge of your life." And so that's the first and most important of all the steps. Secondly, remember I read the passage where it was the despondency of Arjuna. And Arjuna laid down his bow and his arrow because he said, "How can I fight against my teachers, my grandfathers, my brothers, my sisters? How can I fight against all of those? It's unrighteous and nothing would happen except destruction." And Krishna answered him, you must fight. Christ says something could, you know, when the Christian missionaries came to India and saw the Gita for the first time, they assumed that it had to come after the Bible because the teachings were so similar. In fact, it came well before the Bible, but the teachings are virtually similar. And this could just as easily have been in the Gita as in the Bible. Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I am come not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. So, if you read that passage raw without understanding what Christ is really saying, it sounds twisted. It sounds not only like not good advice, but a terrible teaching, where you take up the sword against your own family. But when we understand the meaning of family, that the mother, the father, remember, the father represents the tendencies of past lives or the sense tendencies from past lives. The son or daughter represent those sense pleasures in this life. Master, I don't think interpreted mother-in-law, but we can all figure out something that would work for that. But the understanding here that that which is closest to us in terms of our familial, not only family, but our conditioning, is also that which holds us back. And until we're ready to renounce that and leave that and go out on our own, then we're held back. And in fact, many, many people here at Ananda have had literally that experience, that when they come on the spiritual path, and especially when they dedicate their life to a spiritual path and come to a community, they're fought against by their family, by their father, their mother, their mother-in-law, their brothers, their sisters. Many, many people have experienced that. And it's the old familial tendency trying to hold us back from our growth. And in fact, I have seen, not always, but very often, when a person decides to move to Ananda, to one of the communities, it is at that time that he is offered something, he or she is offered something that has been a deep desire of their heart. The perfect job comes along. The uncle says, I'll put you in my will, but not if you're going to move to that place. The perfect person comes along, except for the fact, the one tiny little problem, that they don't believe in all this stuff. And so in many, many cases, people are individually tested at that time when they make a commitment. And we have to break through that old familial patterning in order to expand and in order to take the next step. The third one that I chose from the Gita had to do with proper action, acting in such a way that we act properly, act dharmically, but we don't look for the fruits or the material fruits of our action, that we see our actions as being something that in fact aligns us with God. Now, is that reflected in the Bible? How about this? Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my name's sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted were they the prophets which were before you. So here's again a very, very clear parallel that when our actions are in alignment with our, well, with God's will, and in fact with our own higher aspirations, if we want peace on earth, then we have to become the peacemakers. But that desire for peace on earth is a desire for a higher aspect of our own self, which is in fact God. One of the ways that God manifests is through peace. And so our souls hunger for peace and won't be satisfied until we find it. And so we look here, look there. Lo, do we find it in the world? No. We must first find it in our own self by becoming peacemakers. Then that resonating, that sense of singing the song of peace is heard by those around, and it changes the world. Anandamoyi Ma said something very beautiful and something to keep in mind. Someone was asking her about the restlessness of their mind in meditation. And she said, joy is the natural food of the mind. And we will always be hungry and restless until we find that joy. So you cannot calm the mind until we find our higher resonance with the qualities of God. In this case, joy is what she was specifically talking about. But the natural food of the mind is God and God's qualities. And we must eat of that food, or we will feel that we're starving and we will look anywhere for some scrap of food to hold off that starvation. So act in accordance with these higher principles, and they will not only will they fulfill you, but we will become beacons of light and of positive change for the world. Okay, number four, if you remember, you probably don't because I have to look at my notes in order to remember, was that we have to practice the techniques of the spiritual path. And it was the incoming breath mixing with the outgoing breath, so that we have to practice the techniques of these of the spiritual life, especially Kriya Yoga, which brings the energy inward. The primary purpose of Kriya is that as the energy comes in through the medulla and descends at each of the chakras, it goes out into the world, creating the appearance that the world is real, that it's solid, and that all of the dramas and all of the sukha dukkha dham and all of the potentials, that they're all real, but they aren't all real. They're all created by consciousness. And as we do every Sunday, we get to the point where when we want to know reality, we first have to realize all that I thought was darkness was but light, and all that I thought was light was but darkness. How do I find that? Well, our spiritual path is the way. But here Jesus says, the light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. Obviously, the single eye is the spiritual eye. And when our eye is single, when our concentration is single, then our whole body, our whole consciousness is full of light. And in fact, the mind then is feasting on that light, its own natural food. But if thine eye be evil, thy whole body shall be full of darkness. So what does it mean, evil? Master said that evil is simply misunderstanding. It's making a mistake. There isn't inherent evil in a certain way. There's direction away from God, direction toward God. That which takes us away from God, one could call that error or evil. And so that's what he's seeing here. But if thine eye be evil, meaning our eyes taking us away from the withdrawing of the energy and bringing it toward the spiritual eye, thy whole body shall be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness? So that's why we didn't read the passage in the Rubaiyat, but Master had an interpretation in there that how long does it take before we feel the anguishing monotony and we decide to bring our energies in and lift them up toward the single eye? How long does it take? How long do we chase those phantoms of the darkness? A long, long time. In one passage, Master interpreted it that some of those who were born into the day of Brahma are still playing in the world at the end of that day of Brahma, billions and billions of years. And so that's what it means by error. And if that's where our eyes are turned, then our consciousness is full of darkness. And how great is that darkness? It can be very great. But as soon as we turn inwardly and look toward the spiritual eye, then our body becomes filled with light. Our mind becomes filled with light. And our consciousness is that of an extension of God. And then finally, I read the passage that was, well, I'll read it again because it's so beautiful. Absorb yourself in me, be wholly devoted to me, worship and bow to me alone. So shall you undoubtedly reach me. This I promise you faithfully, for you are dear to me. And Christ says, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto us. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So the complete, the heart, mind, soul, and strength represent our desires, our heart's energies, the chitwa. The mind represents the thoughts. Strength is a little hard for people who haven't had the teachings, but it represents our life force, and our soul is that eternal part that is the true self. When all of those love the Lord thy God with all of it, then the Lord says to us, I shall certainly come to you, for you are very precious to me. So these teachings from the Bible and from the Bhagavad Gita are really basically very simple. The spiritual path is very simple, that we choose God, we act correctly, we do our sadhana, and we love God with all of our heart, But that last one is the most important of all. There is one thing that rules them all, and in God's light binds them, and that's the love of God.
So just to let you know, what we're basing a lot of our talk on this morning is the third book, The Revelations of Christ, proclaimed by Paramahansa Yogananda and presented by his disciple, Swami Kriyananda. Now, once we know the story that Christ appeared in the Himalayas to Babaji and said essentially, "What in the world have they done with my teachings?" And he said, "Can you send someone into the world to show the true meaning of what I brought?" And that person, of course, was our guru, Yoganandaji, who came through the line of Jesus, Babaji, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sriteshwar, and Master. And Master, as we know, called his mission the second coming of Christ. And you know, no word dropped from those exalted lips that didn't have profound meaning. And so his calling, his mission, the second coming of Christ, was not just a random statement. It was because it was the time in the development of the world for the meaning of these teachings to be really clarified and presented. So Master was asked, is what you have brought a new religion? He said, no, it's a new expression of ancient truths. And he also said it was a special dispensation. And these two statements are very important for us, because if we understand that at this point in time, a new expression of ancient truths that we've been talking about and will continue to talk about tomorrow with the study of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, if these truths are a new expression has been given at this point in time, but more than just a new expression, a new dispensation. And this is very important for us, because what does this mean? It means there's a carrier wave of divine consciousness and magnetism that has the power to transform those of us, thousands of youths, to understand and transform our lives. So a special dispensation. Those are thrilling words. It isn't just like, here, read this book. It's, you know, when we were in India, I think I mentioned, we were in different groups in different cities, Noida and Delhi and Gurgaon, and in informal situations, we would ask people, how did you come to this path? And almost without variation, people said, I read the autobiography of a yogi. And people said, my mother gave it to me, or my father, or my friend. One person said, I don't even know how I got it. I walked into my house and there it was on the table one day. But every single one said, I read that book and it changed my life. And that's the special dispensation, the ray of that light that's gone out that not only gives us commentaries, because there have been commentaries, perhaps not as profound as what Master gave, but gave us the power to understand them, and more than just to understand them, to use them to transform our consciousness. So in the Bible, Christ says, speaking of his new dispensation, he said, you do not pour new wine into old wineskins, because it will crack it and be lost. Nor do you sew a new patch on an old garment, because it won't hold. Well, what this new wine is the new expression of God consciousness that Jesus brought to the world at that time. And the old wineskins, those were the minds at that time that were trapped in dogmatism and bigotry and the search for power and control and wealth and everything that he berated the money changers and the Pharisees for. Oh, ye of little faith. He called them serpents and vipers. He was not pleased with what they were doing with God's teachings. And so this new wine that he brought was to invigorate, bring new life into the lost children of Israel. And yet, when we think about it, that wine was poured 2,000 years ago. And yet, it has not yet been drunk to the depths of what it, of the transforming power it contains. That wine is still in the bottle, yet to be absorbed. Last summer, we went to visit our community in Assisi, and as part of that trip, we were traveling with our granddaughter, and we took her to different places around Italy, and we went to the Vatican. Well, talk about old wineskins. It was perfect, except there was not an iota of inspiration. Every piece of art, every statue, every column and pillar and marble floor, and yet there was no life in it. It was a sepulcher. It was a tomb. Let the dead bury their dead. And now we see this, the Pope is stepping down. There's a profound change going because there is no new wine that can be poured into those wineskins. So what, let us ask ourselves the question, what are some aspects of this new wine that Christ poured and the Master took up the chalice and he said, your children have not yet drunk this wine. I will take it up and I will offer it to them again as a new expression with a special dispensation. And so let's look at different aspects of what this new wine represents. The first one is making the transition from fear to love, to a condemning God, to a loving God. And again, in the Sistine Chapel, of course, there's the world-renowned image, beautifully restored, I mean, of the, you know, the Last Judgment, and God, you know, condemning the sinners with this look on his face like, oh my God, you've done it again, and the angry Father. But it says in the Bible, God didn't send his Son into this world to condemn it, but to save it. And there are so many beautiful illustrations of that. One of my favorite, and I don't know why, maybe I was there, but I see it so vividly whenever I read it. And so the Pharisees, the old wineskins, were always trying to challenge Jesus. And so they bring to him a woman taken in adultery. And the law says she must be stoned to death. And they're all standing there with their stone. One can just see it. It's beautifully depicted in that film, Jesus of Nazareth. And there she is. She's been berated and dragged through the streets. And she's hysterical and crying. And she's just cowering in a corner by a wall, knowing that these men with bloodlust and holding their stones are about to stone her to death. And it said, and Jesus was sitting nearby, drawing in the sand. I love that image, the hatred and the violence and the agitation. And there's Christ centered in the truth of God. And they said, Rabbi, the law says we should condemn this woman and stone her to death. What say you? And without looking up, he says, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Transforming from fear and judgment to transcendental love. And it said, and one by one, they dropped their stones and walked away. What a beautiful, beautiful story and image. If that was all that Christ had done, it would have been enough to guide our lives. But then he also made the transition, fear to love, from law and rules to truth and grace. It says in the Bible, Moses brought us the law, but Christ brought us truth and grace. And that truth and grace, it's not another religion. It's Sanatana Dharma, the eternal religion that is the underlying reality of all creation. I loved what Swamiji said. He said, even if the world was totally destroyed and every living creature gone up in smoke, Sanatana Dharma would still exist in the very atoms of creation on the farthest planet of known creation, because it's not based on human reality. Truth and grace is based on a transcendental reality. And it's everything we've been talking about. All of these things, we're not talking about religion. We're talking about reality beneath our consciousness, beneath our lives, beneath all of our activities. And again, they were always trying to challenge Christ, to get him to contradict the law of the time. And he said, I did not come to break the law, but to fulfill the law and the prophets, to bring them to the, fulfill, meaning to bring them to the higher expression of them. And remember, they said, but Master, it says in the law that we should not gather on the harvest, on the Sabbath, excuse me, should not harvest on the Sabbath. And what does Christ say? The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. We weren't made for the law. The law was made to bring us closer to an experience of God realization. And again, they tried to get him in trouble with the Romans, and they said, should we pay taxes to the Romans, Master? And he takes a coin and he says, whose picture is on this coin? And they say, Caesar's. He said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Give him the money. What difference does it make? It's not real. And so they were always trying to trick him and trap him, but he transcended it with truth and grace and love. And then another one aspect of this new wine is the movement from blind belief and rigidity to experience. And you know, so many of the saints coming through Christianity, up from Christianity, their greatest challenge came from other members of their own church, because they were experiencing something, a reality. And they were saying, no, 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 that doesn't go according to our rules and our books. No one ever talks about that. And St. Teresa of Avila, you know, she kept having this experience, the experience of the formless Christ, of Christ beyond just what they were limiting. And for years and years, her spiritual advisor said, no, you can't have that experience. You have to believe what we tell you, but you can't have the experience. But Christ said, remember, to the woman of Samaria, you worship what ye know not. I know what it is that I worship. And what he's telling us, don't just go by what you've been taught. We have to experience it. And that's Master's whole path, that we can experience for ourselves states of higher spiritual consciousness, not just read a book, not just, you know, India is a great spiritual land, but it also is bound by blind belief so much. And that's part of why it's so thrilling to be bringing Master's teachings there, because the Indians are hungry for the truth and the depth of their own teachings. So to move to experiencing, we know the story of St. Anthony of the Desert, another one of the great saints of Christendom. And he was one of the desert fathers, ascetics, and he would live. By the way, if you haven't read the book, Saints That Move the World, do read it. It is the most beautiful presentation of the great saints of Christianity. It was out of print for a long time, and now it's back in print. A beautiful presentation of St. Teresa, St. Anthony, St. Francis, and others, St. John of the Cross. Not St. John of the Cross, St. John. I guess that is of the cross. Okay. But in the life of St. Anthony, he lived in the desert in a cave, in a tomb, one of the old Egyptian tombs. And he would, whenever he was, so great was his spiritual magnetism that young disciples would come and they would live in little tombs around him. And as soon as there got to be too many, he'd go farther out into the desert and farther out. And finally, he, you know, was very inaccessible, which is what he wanted. And at the time in Christianity, this was just not very long after Christ had lived and taught, several hundred years only, there became this great controversy in Christianity that part of it said Christ was a prophet and a holy man, but just another person like us. And the other said, no, he was a divine incarnation, a son of God. And there was this great controversy, and it was tearing the church apart. And there was a big synod, let's say, because that's such a fun word that we don't get to use a lot, except in crossword puzzles. And there was a great synod in the city of Alexandria. And St. Anthony came, and they begged him to come. They went out into the desert and found him in his cave in Dura, and he didn't want to come into the haunts of man. But he knew that it was the will of God that he did so, so he came. And there's this huge controversy, raging argument, how foolish we mortals are. You know, Christ is the Son of God. No, Christ is just a holy man, and you're wrong, and I hate you. And, you know, it's just like, how can we be so foolish? But so St. Anthony just stood there at the door of the church, and he let this argument go on and on until finally he had had enough, and he stepped forward, and he said four words, I have seen him. And such was the power of his consciousness that it totally destroyed the controversy, and it healed Christianity at that very pivotal time in its history. And so not just belief, but experience. And again, when you look at our line of gurus, Lahiri Mahashaya, getting Kriya from Babaji in the Himalayas, and asking, can I give this to sincere men and women everywhere, not just people who are willing to totally renounce their lives? And Babaji said, God has spoken through you. And because of that, we have the transforming power of Kriya. Because of that, we have the ability to go beyond belief and to experience. You know, Master said of Kriya, give me a group of boys, even the worst sort, and if they practice Kriya the way I tell them, they will become saints. Not just good people, but their consciousness will be united with God. So we have been given a path of experience. And this is the transition. This is the new wine. And experience versus belief is very threatening to the church. Because if we don't need to go to church, if we can sit at home in our own meditation room and experience God's presence and his grace and his guidance and his blessings, and then we don't go to church, who will be there to fill the coffers? Who will be there to obey us? And so this aspect of belief versus experience is a great threat to the old wineskins. And then we come to the new wine of worshiping God as form or worshiping him as spirit. And again, so many stories from the Bible that Christ says of worshiping God as form. Remember, it's a curious one, but Moses goes up onto the mount to get the Ten Commandments. And while he's gone, what do the children of Israel do? Let's make a golden calf and we'll worship that. Well, it's probably symbolic. I don't know if they really made a golden calf, but it's worshiping materialism. But that aspect of looking for the form, and that's again in India where it gets so, it's a limitation unless you understand the deeper meaning of the form. But Christ says, God is spirit, and he that worship him, who would worship him, must worship him in spirit and in truth. And how do we worship God in spirit and in truth? Well, still your mind if you want to pray. Still your heart, still your soul if you want to pray. It's by deep interiorization. When we experience ourselves no more as the ego and the body and the personality, and we can do it. Don't put up a veil. We can do it. When we are in that deeply interiorized state, that beautiful chant, I love, heart to heart beating, spirit and soul meeting. It's when we go deep within that we can experience that presence, just as St. Teresa did of the formless Christ, which was a deeper state than just worshiping outwardly and doing your prayers and doing your rituals. So when we meditate, that should be our goal. Start with the techniques, but then go beyond the techniques and sit in the silence and try to feel, just as that beautiful verse from the Rubaiyat, a loaf of bread, a jug of wine beneath the bough, and thou beside me in the wilderness singing, O wilderness is paradise enow. So that's the state of worshiping God beyond form. In that stillness where you feel that touch on your consciousness, and it comes in so many, many beautiful little ways. Beautiful. Just this morning, I was getting ready to come over and I had put my ring on the dresser last night and then I was looking for it and I couldn't find it and I didn't have a lot of time, so I just said, oh, Divine Mother, you'll help me find it. And then I saw behind the wastebasket a little piece of paper and I thought, oh, I'll pick that up and throw it in the wastebasket. And there was my ring. God was just saying, okay, I'll have to guide you through your desire to clean up the floor and then you'll find your ring. But to experience that God is spirit and to walk in that spirit, in that truth and grace, feel it with you all the time. It's never not there, never not there. Another time many years ago, as Master instructed us, I had memorized the poem Samadhi. And if you haven't done that yet, do it. And repeat it. Don't just say, okay, I memorized it, now let's move on. Repeat it regularly because it tunes you into that state that Master was bringing us towards. And I had memorized this poem and I was going for a little walk one day and my eyes were kind of half closed as much as I could. And there's that one lovely line, the sparrow, a grain of sand, falls not without my sight. And just as I said that line, I took a step and I felt a little something under my foot and I looked down. And there was a little sparrow that had fallen out of the tree and was dead, and it was just lying there. And that reminds me also of a beautiful story we've shared recently from the life of Ananda Moy Ma, where she was with a small group of disciples, three or four of them, and one of them was a man who was new to her, but very devoted, and he couldn't understand why she was always traveling. You know, she never stayed in one place, and in his ignorance, he thought, why is Ma so restless? And then one day she said, let's go for a picnic by the lake. And so there were three or four of them, and they went for a picnic by this lake. And then in the middle of things, she said, we have to go now. And he thought, oh, here she is. She's restless again. We just got here. And they said, okay, let's finish. And she said, no, we have to go now. And she just started walking off. And so they gathered up the things and started following after her. And just as they got to a place in the road, there was a little bird that had fallen out of a tree. And there was a little boy with the group, and she said, go run and pick up the little bird. And he picked up the little bird, and he held it right up to Ma's eyes. And the little bird, just fallen out of the nest, just looked deeply into her eyes and fluttered its wings a little bit and then died. And Ma said he was wanting darshan. And she could feel that. The sparrow falls not without his sight or her sight. And that spirit is without form, and it's our best beloved, and we need to walk in that grace and believe in that grace in our lives. And then man, the new wine, the transition from man as a sinner to man as a spark of the divine consciousness. And, you know, we're brought up so much about good and evil and so forth, and we've sinned and all that. But Christ doesn't say that. He says, don't your scriptures say that ye are gods? And Swamiji said that Master often quoted the lines from the Bible, to as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. This is the second coming of Christ, that we realize whatever the lives of all men are dark with many stains, said Sri Yukteswar, all things in future will improve if we're making the right spiritual effort now. And so to make the new wine that Master is pouring into our cups is to see ourselves as children of the light, as sparks of the divine, as the immortal soul. Just as the Gita tells us, the soul cannot be destroyed. The soul is permanent, everlasting, pure, a reflection of that light. And so the more we can see ourselves in this way, this is the second coming of Christ ultimately. It's our own awakening in Christ consciousness, beyond religion, beyond beliefs, but the awakening in Christ consciousness. This is the new wine. Just as we were talking yesterday, the wine represents the bliss of God's communion. This is the true communion, the wine of that beautiful state when you realize that this world has no hold on me. I am a child of God, and I am free in that. And so these scriptures that we've been discussing, and of course we have one more tomorrow, and what the Patanjali, and one might ask the question, well, what we know that the Bible and the Gita are scriptures in the sense that we understand them. And in fact, as we know, Master said, it was the will of Babaji to compare these two. But why Patanjali, that we'll be studying tomorrow? Because, why did Master give an explanation of it? Because in this time, the teachings of yoga are coming. It's the age of yoga. Dwapara Yuga is the age of yoga practices. But who's going to explain them? Who's going to tell you really what yoga is, how to meditate, unless we look back to the true source? And Patanjali is the source of the teachings and practice of Raja Yoga. And that's why Master gave them, brought them to the light again. And so these scriptures should be living realities in our hearts. I love this story from the life of St. Francis. I'm going to get a little drink of water, and then I'll tell you the story. St. Francis had already begun his mission, had had the experience, the turning point in his life where he perceived Christ on the cross at the little broken-down chapel of San Damiano, and Christ told him, to St. Francis, Francis, from the cross, Christ spoke, rebuild my church, which, as you can see, has fallen into ruin. In his simplicity, Francis thought that Jesus was talking about the little broken-down chapel of San Damiano. But what he was talking about was the spirit of Christianity, to bring again, even at that time in the 1100s, to re-bring the new wine to the people. And it for a period, it gave it rebirth. And Francis began his mission. And he clung to the words of Christ. His only possession was, he had a little brown ragged robe, little belt, little begging bowl, one presumes, and then the Bible, the word of Jesus. And that's all he had. And he treasured that Bible. And he would read it and read it and read it till his eyes grew dim. And then one day in his wanderings, he came upon a poor beggar woman, even poorer than he. And she had nothing. And out of his incredible kindness and compassion, he gave her his Bible, all that he had, his most beloved possession, and thinking that she could sell it and get some money for it. And then she walked away, and he went back to his little hut where he was living, and he cried, and he said, "Master, Lord Jesus, my beloved, I've given away your word now. I have nothing." And Christ appeared to him, and he said, "Francis, my beloved child, you don't need the Bible. My words are forever imprinted in your heart." And so they were. And so for all of us, it's good to study what we've been doing this week, but far better to have these words forever embedded in our hearts so that every action, every thought, every feeling is an expression of the truths that these great masters have given us.